My name's Mackenzie, and I started a GoFundMe for the adoptive mother of a nonverbal autistic child. The mother had lost her job because she wasn't able to find adequate care for this autistic child. So she really needed some help with living expenses, paying some back bills. So I launched a GoFundMe to help support them during this crisis. And we raised about $10,000 within just a couple of months. I think that the surprising thing was by telling a clear story and just like really being very clear about what we needed, we had some really generous donations from people who were really moved by the situation that this family was struggling with.
GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform trusted by over 200 million people. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This podcast is supported by GoFundMe.
The weather in Central Ohio just got better, and so should your loan rate. CME Federal Credit Union wants to try to beat your current loan rate by 2% on autos and toys. Plus, enjoy no payments for 90 days on car loans and no payments for 60 days on motorcycles, boats, and more. With car rates as low as 4.9% APR and toy rates starting at 6.5% APR, it's the perfect time to save. Apply today at CMEFCU.org. Terms apply. Minimum floor rates 4.99% APR car, 6.5% APR other vehicles. Federally insured by NCUA.
The Empire Podcast this week, we go to Glenrothen for a question of succession with Brian Cox in his directorial debut. Och aye, laddie. It's going to be very Scottish. All this and the usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast that really cannot believe that any Northern Irish man would turn down second breakfast, if we're honest. So that casting has got some way to go to convince us. Hello, Pod. I'm Helen O'Hara. Welcome to the Empire Podcast, coming to you this week from our usual pod booth, but without our usual pod host. Yes, Chris has finally been persuaded to take a short break to relax, to recharge, and to hopefully have a wonderful time on a cruise ship. Yeah, he's on a cruise. In fact, he actually just messaged, they've just boarded, and he said that Sandra Bullock and Jason Patrick are also aboard, as well as a guy he's pretty sure was Willem Dafoe. So that's lovely. So I'm sure he's going to have a lovely, relaxing time. That was a speed 2 joke, guys.
Yep. Cruise control.
Anyway, yes, fear not, I am still joined by two colleagues of such lethal cunning. First up, a man who has killed more bowls of cereal than you've had hot dinners. Wait, am I reading that right? Something like that. Anyway, it's Ben Travis. Hello.
Oh, bowls of cereal?
Yeah, like a cereal killer.
Oh, a cereal killer. To be fair, I'm a big cereal person.
Yeah. What's your go-to?
Ooh, okay. My favorite, like, semi-serious but semi-treat cereal is the little Weetabix with the chocolate in it. The mini chocolate Weetabix.
Okay.
Are great. At the moment, I am on some own brand Crave, you know, like chocolate pillows. Mm-hmm. Really not good for you, but really good for feeling happy in the morning. So,
wow. Weetabix is also one of my favorites. I remain flabbergasted that there was not some sort of We Live in Time Weetabix collaboration, given what they do with Weetabix in that film.
There should have been. Well, you've heard him, but I haven't even introduced him yet. It's the man they call Mr. Invincible because he won't shut up about Invincible. It's Amon Worman. How are you doing?
I'm doing good, but have you seen Invincible? There's a reason I'm not shutting up about it. This show is incredible.
I hear this week's was amazing.
This is one of the best episodes, if not the best episode of the entire run.
You see, I told you.
yes, there's a character called Grand Regent Thrag. it makes sense. I mean, he's actually
that's somebody who is a big fan of Grand Admiral Thrawn and just really wanted him.
This is true. But he's voiced by Lee Pace of Foundation.
Oh, okay. Helen, all right.
And the way Helen's entire body language just shifted at the mention of Lee Pace. You physically sat her.
Hey, he's my birthday twin. Gotta love him. So, yeah.
Big week for Lee Pace. We'll get to it.
Yes, we will. Okay.
But it's so interesting going into the episode. A lot of people who hadn't read the comics, they weren't really vibing with his performance and they weren't really vibing with the character. Then episode 7, which is the one that's just aired, has happened. And the guy has basically put belt to ass on every single one of our heroes in just the most ridiculous commanding way. And everyone's tune on Thrag has changed. And the Invincible social media accounts are actually leading into it, which is very, very funny. They're like, anyone else want to call Thrag a Ford now? Like, speak up now. Nobody wants to say anything.
Everyone is
what people were saying going into the episode. And now everyone's tune has changed because, my goodness, Thrag... He's not even in the same league. He's playing a different sport to what these guys play. There's one, like, Invincible, who is the title character, one of the most powerful characters in the show. He's feeling all confident because he's just bested Conquest, who is a really big bad, and he's killed him. Says, I've killed Conquest. I can kill you, too. So I was like, okay, show me.
This is not... an Invincible spoiler.
I know, but you got me started now. Dagger's like, okay, show me. Invincible winds up, goes for a big super punch. Thrag doesn't even flinch. And he's just like, I'm not impressed. And it continues on that level of beatdown for the entire episode. It's incredible.
And then what happens?
No. Yeah. We simply do not have time. I'm sorry. Okay. That's very nice, dear. Or I'm sorry that happened. But either way.
If that doesn't convince you to watch this show, I don't know what you're
doing. Look, there's a lot of shows, okay? You know, I'll maybe get to it one day. I've never taken a position against it. I simply, like, life is too short. We do have to take a question. We have a couple of contenders this week, so I feel like let's see how far we get. I quite like this one, but it may be playing because it plays to my interest rather than y'all's interest. So we're gonna start with this. This came via Instagram from Axel Malice. And the question is, long-time American listener here, just back from a trip to London with my wife and kids for spring break. Ah, oh, that's nice. Lovely town that
spring
we have.
Spring break!
So the question came to him as we were enjoying the brilliant My Neighbor Totoro stage production. Incredible. Mm-hmm. What are the best stage productions that originated as films, do we think? So that is the question. So Totoro is definitely, I think we would all say, a contender, right? Yeah. That is... Yeah. Gorgeous.
It's so beautiful. And when I saw it, when it got to the interval, I was like, I kind of feel the need to cry, not because it's emotionally heavy, but I feel so enchanted in a way that is so rare to feel. It put me in a really childlike state in a way that nothing else really does, in a very magical way. And it was like, if you've not had a chance to see it yet, or if you're planning to come to London to do some theatre stuff, if you have any interest in Ghibli, my God, it is so good. And when they start bringing the Totoros out, you will gasp.
It is exactly that. It's the feeling of magic. It's the feeling of... I'm still not 100% convinced that that's a puppet. I think it actually is Totoro.
They just found a Totoro.
And the puppeteers are just there to make us, like... You know, plausible deniability.
They're like stewards.
Right? They're stewards.
Bodyguards,
exactly.
Even.
Essentially, they're there to stop people like me jumping on stage and trying to hug Totoro.
Also, when I grow up, I kind of want to be the person who's at the front of, like, the cat bus situation. Because the cat bus comes to town.
Yeah.
It's a magical thing.
I mean, if we're talking puppetry, I think we also have to talk about The Lion King.
Hell yeah.
Which is kind of one of the first big, you know, Disney shows to do that. I still think that the baby elephant in that parade of animals at the end is one of the cutest things I have ever seen in any theater. I guess the lions are good too. But for me, it's all about the baby elephant who appears in like two scenes.
And the giraffes. To get to be a giraffe with all the long limbs. But both of those shows have an interestingly similar approach where they don't hide the puppeteers on stage. You are, like, on the one hand, just seeing these characters exist as real characters, but also it lets you see the artistry that creates those characters without breaking the illusion in a weird way. It's kind of amazing. They do that in Totoro as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Mon, how about you?
I've seen The Lion King. That was good. I've seen one of my most memorable ones was Back to the Future with you, Helen.
Yeah, that's right.
Which was really, really cool. The effects and how they close out that show, I still don't know how it was magical. That was brilliant. I haven't seen... I want to see more. I know that you guys have gone on about the Groundhog Day. Which I need to check that out.
Yes.
So great.
And I think the only other one that I've seen is the Prince of Egypt musical, which was solid. I still think the movie is better. the movie is incredible. I think one of my very first cinema experiences, by the way, was The Prince of Egypt. I remember being sat next to my mum and Moses splitting the Red Sea and just like being in absolute awe. Incredible. But yeah, I want to see more. I know, but Totoro especially as well.
Yeah, definitely get a chance to see Totoro. And Groundhog Day, I'm so glad they brought it back a couple of years
ago. Me too,
because
yeah.
It is a brilliant show. And you think of Groundhog Day as being, you know, the film being so singular because of the Bill Murray performance. You think, what is Groundhog Day without Bill Murray? And the way that they get past that, and they sort of build that into the show a bit as well. There are like Ghostbusters jokes in
Ghostbusters
in the
songs. 2 specifically. Ghostbusters 2.
And the songs are genius, and it really digs even further into the themes that are very much there in the film about what that eternal winter means, what it maybe represents, the sort of spiritual, existential, mental health, you know, analogy of all of that. They really get into it in a deeper way, whilst also, you know, doing the thing that musicals do when you're set in a town and you can have songs from other townspeople and you get other perspectives on things. So it's so smartly done. And, you know, Tim Minchin is just a genius musically on that front.
Yeah.
The producers we only just talked about with Richard Kindon at the moment is up there because, you know, that is famously a show that was so good that it went back to the screen. Because it was so successful as a theatrical experience.
Have any of you guys watched The Devil Wears Prada? I see that big old red shoe in town.
Yeah, it's going great guns, as is Dirty Dancing. I have to confess, I haven't seen either of those. I've let you all down.
Helen, have you seen... Wait, I haven't, but have you seen Bring It On, the musical with songs by Lin-Manuel
Miranda? Yes, that was fun. I think there was a little raft of, you know, that, Mean Girls, Heathers, which are all solid. I don't think they're up there with like Groundhog Day or Matilda in terms of musically or lyrically or anything else, but they're fun. They're fine. They're totally cool. You know, if you like the film, you'll like the show, but not top tier for me, I think. And then there's all the Disney ones, which I think are quite variable. Now, we haven't had the chance over here to see, I think, all of them. I don't know if The Little Mermaid has ever been here. I think, you know, Frozen for me was just okay on stage. I think Mary Poppins was terrifying on stage, and that
terrifying?
Was very much...
Intentionally so?
I'm not sure. I think she's one of those characters where unless Julie Andrews is playing her, she's actually quite scary.
Mm-hmm.
You thought Emily Blunt was scary?
No, actually, okay, that's probably fair. But
good
like,
caveat.
But the whole thing in the show is like there's a whole number where basically the kids are put on trial for being mean to their toys. And if you've ever been a child, that's actually quite a terrifying prospect because at some point you've thrown your doll across the room.
Did you see Mary Poppins or Lee Cronin's Mary Poppins? Because there's a real big difference.
Lee Cronin's The Mummy Poppins. Yeah. Yeah, it wasn't as comforting and cuddly as I expected it to be, put it that way.
I'm going to give you one that's comforting and cuddly, but is totally just off-piste for what this is. But it was in a theatrical setting.
Okay.
I was lucky enough, before they closed it down, to go to Muppet Vision 3D at Disney World. And you go into the Muppet Theater, and a lot of it is like 3D stuff on a screen, but they have... an animatronic Statler and Waldorf who like heckle from the sidelines in the theater, and a real Mr. Snuffleupagus walks across the stage as part of the show, and that was a very magical experience.
Okay, that does sound fun. I saw a Muppet thing in the theater, but I don't think it was that one. It was quite short.
Lee Cronin's the Muppets.
Yeah, I'm just terrified by everything. We're going to get to Lee Cronin's The Mummy at some point in this show, but. Yeah, I think those are the big ones that spring to mind. I'm sure we're missing like huge stuff. Like I'm not counting things like Wicked or the Harry Potter play or any of those that are kind of continuations or prequels or whatever else of an existing story. I think that's a different thing.
Mm-hmm.
But just the ones based on plays. I have also seen like plays, not just, you know, sort of musicals and so on, based on movies like Rain Man, Came to London, stuff like that. Those can be pretty good. I think it's very much down to casting in that sense and, you know, how well they were suited for the stage in the beginning. Like 12 Angry Men, of course, worked pretty damn well on the stage. Rain Man was fine. Magic Mike Live, I have to confess, I haven't seen.
Have you not?
That's
I know.
That's genuinely
I know. I genuinely think it would be a bit much. for me.
Okay.
I'm not sure I'm there yet.
You'd be fainting in the aisles, Victorian.
Style. Yes, I think I might be clutching my pearls and I don't even have any. So it would be a very confusing time. So I don't know about that. Yeah. I also have a couple more questions. Let's move on because I do want to cover another couple of things. I don't know about this one. I'm interested to see what you guys think. So this comes from Conrad Mayers II on Instagram as well. Who is the best male damsel in distress? I was watching Cutthroat Island for the soundtrack, I swear, he says. And Matthew Modine is hilariously good at getting himself captured and rescued. Do you have any other favourites?
The one that immediately came to mind was Steve Trevor in Wonder Woman.
Is he a damsel in distress, though? Because he, to me, is more of a partner in not crime.
Wonder Woman saves him a bunch in that film.
Does she?
There's that one scene where they're in the alley and...
she has to with the gauntlet or with the bracelet.
Yeah, and I need to... It's been a while since I watched it, but you know, him winding up on the island... Yeah, he has to be safe there. Like, he's in distress quite a bit, and Diana's always there to help him out.
That's fair. Okay. Yeah. I mean, I don't want to be controversial, but I think my favorite might be Samuel L. Jackson in The Long Kiss Goodnight, because he does have to be saved a fair bit by Geena Davis, who is, of course, a deadly assassin, and extremely, extremely good at her job. And he is like an ordinary private eye who is a bit over his head. But I love their relationship because, you know, he's Samuel L. Jackson. He's not just a damsel in distress. So he's kind of like unhappy with how things are turning out. And it's just a really good dynamic. I think it's really, really fun.
It's a bad film, but Ghosted, Chris Evans and Cole Turner.
Chris Evans and Ana de Armas, because she has to keep like saving him.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. It's not a good film, but like...
It's not a good film.
He is a damsel a lot.
I rewatched, don't ask me why, I rewatched Underworld the other night.
Why? Sorry, I got to know.
I'll be honest, my husband saw the picture of her in the catsuit and was like, why don't we watch Underworld?
Totally fair. Kate Beckinsale is a hottie.
But Scott Speedman in that film is 100% damsel. Like he is absolutely in distress the whole time. He has no idea what's going on. He doesn't know who to trust. Anytime he does trust someone, they try to kill him. Like he's just having a bad day. Bless him. And, you know, swishing his blonde locks probably in the wind. Yeah.
I mean, it can't be that bad a day. He's been saved by Kate Beckinsale.
That is true. And eventually loses his shirt, as all good damsels apparently do at some point. So, yeah, I guess there's that as well.
I feel like we're so used to seeing Tom Cruise in like action hero mode that then seeing him in Edge of Tomorrow when he is not the Full Metal bitch in that situation. That's always a nice like flipping of the dynamic with him and Emily Blunt. I mean, obviously Emily Blunt can do all those things. That's not fiction. Sure. She just does that.
She just does that in real life.
Yeah. It's either that or Mary Poppins.
I'm looking forward to seeing her do all those moves in Devil Wears Prada 2. I think that's going to be pretty cool.
I hear she's going to like zord up with Meryl Streep and Anne Hathaway.
Yep.
But that's like, no spoilers, but that's the final
act
of Devil
act.
Wears Prada 2.
My excitement for this film just went up several levels.
I hear they do that in the musical as well, as part of the stage musical.
Let's go there right after
that's
this.
That's why the shoe's so big, because once they're all zorded together,
it's got to fit all three of them.
They've got to fit into the shoe.
Okay, I've got one last little question, because obviously this week has Lee Cronin's The Mummy, which has... You know, no big spoilers, but creepy children in it, I think it's fair to say. It also actually, interestingly, this week sees the release of The Devil's Backbone in 4K. So it really is a big week for creepy children, right? So Clarice Lockery, your cohort on Fade to Black, Amon, has asked us, which horror kid could be fixed by showing them Bluey? And I think that's a great question.
Okay, well, one of my favorite creepy kids in movies of recent years, I'm going to invoke a true cinematic classic known as The Pope's Exorcist.
Wow.
In which, have you guys seen The Pope's Exorcist?
I have seen The Pope's Exorcist.
It's so hilarious. The trope has been done to death of like the possessed child is speaking in a demon voice like this.
Is this the Russell Crowe film?
The Russell Crowe film.
Oh, yeah, I've seen him. Yeah.
Taking it with my boss, the Pope. The child.
Also in the news this week. Yeah.
Oh, wow, it all comes full circle. The kid in The Pope's Exorcist, his, like, possessed voice is Ralph Ineson?
Oh.
So he's like a small boy talking like this. Oh, and he's like talking like this.
Like Galactus.
Like, but like Giza mode.
Ooh, and I'd forgotten that.
The cognitive dissonance of that is hilarious and amazing. But a couple of episodes of Bluey,
right.
And I'm sure he would be fine.
Cricket and Signs and like, boom, done. Mm-hmm. He'd be all right.
You know who could use a couple episodes of Bluey? Brandon Beyer in Brightburn.
Oh, no, genuinely, yes.
Yes.
If they had raised that child on Bluey,
100%.
Different outcome to that film. He would have grown up to be
Superman.
Clark Kent.
It would have been Superman.
Exactly right.
Wait, was he raised on Peppa Pig instead or something? Because Peppa Pig's a really unruly little...
I hear he was raised on Bing.
Ooh.
The worst of all children's cartoons, so I'm told.
And the worst of all search engines.
Oh my God, yes. But yeah, I think those are good calls. I think Danny in The Shining, if he'd spent that winter watching Bluey safely in his room instead of cycling around the corridors on his trike meeting terrifying twins, I think he would have been better off.
Dad needed a few episodes of Bluey
his dad
more than
could
he
also,
did.
His dad could have learned a lot from, isn't it Bandit? It's Bandit, isn't it?
Do you know what? I'm not on the Bluey train yet. I think the Bluey train is pulling into the station fairly soon, but it has not yet arrived
in
my life.
Oh,
so
Ben.
I can correct you on Bluey lore down the line.
You are going to be so into Bluey, you have no idea. You are going to be painting your face like Bandit day to day. You
I'm
don't
ready.
Even know yet.
I'm ready. We're on a Muppets hype train at the moment.
Okay.
Kermit is known as Gurgit in our house. Gurgit.
That's very cute.
It's adorable.
It's very cute. So I do think Bluey could save most of these kids. Obviously, you know, wasn't around in 1930s Spain for the Devil's Backbone, but if he had been, all those orphans would have been happier. I don't know. I mean, the mummy, they do have some physical problems to deal with in that film, which perhaps Bluey alone could not have fixed.
Yeah. But even the powers of Bluey, I'm not sure could quite undo, especially, don't want to spoil too much of the mummy, but maybe the troubled child in this situation is less of a child than a teenager at this point. So maybe, I don't know. I mean, Euphoria is not going to help anything. is there any wholesome teen content? Maybe the odd TikTok dance might have chilled things out.
TikTok dance might have. Well, but then we've seen Megan. And so TikTok dances can really turn against you.
Especially in a James Wan produced film.
Yeah.
Damn it.
I was going to say Abigail, but that's like a 100-year-old demon in the 12-year-old
body.
That's
giving inspo than chilling anybody out.
Yeah.
Club. Everybody comes and just talks about their problems, including the fact that I was maybe mummified for like 8 years. And then we all do a dance at the end. We walk like an Egyptian.
Okay.
And then we play some Simple Minds. We punch the air.
Job done.
Everyone's cool.
Jobs are good. I thought for a second you were suggesting that Bluey could fix the kids in the Breakfast Club.
Oh.
And I was interested in that notion as well, because I think if they'd come into detention, made a pillow fort or like a blanket fort, and just all got in and watched Bluey, that could also have helped them, if
I'm
honest.
However, big week for pillow forts, because I don't know if you guys saw the Insidious trailer, the new Insidious trailer, in which there is a spooky pillow fort. So
again
is where James Wan plus pillow forts gets you. It's not into a Bluey place, it gets you into a spooky Insidious further place.
There is so much synergy this week in our discussion already. Oh my God. Chris thinks he's the only one who can do a segue. Well, he probably is. But
was that going to be a segue?
Not really. Okay, let's leave it there for the questions. That's more than enough.
My name is Mackenzie, and I started a GoFundMe for the adoptive mother of a nonverbal autistic child. The mother had lost her job because she wasn't able to find adequate care for this autistic child. So she really needed some help with living expenses, paying some back bills. So I launched a GoFundMe to help support them during this crisis. And we raised about $10,000 within just a couple of months. I think that the surprising thing was by telling a clear story and just like really being very clear about what we needed, we had some really generous donations from people who were really moved by the situation that this family was struggling with.
GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform trusted by over 200 million people. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This podcast is supported by GoFundMe.
The weather in Central Ohio just got better, so why shouldn't your loan rate? CME Federal Credit Union wants to try to beat your current loan rate by 2% on autos and toys. Plus, enjoy no payments for 90 days on car loans and no payments for 60 days on motorcycles, boats, and more. With car rates as low as 4.99% APR and toy rates starting at 6.5% APR, it's the perfect time to save. Apply today at CMEFCU.org.
Terms apply. Minimum floor rates, 4.99% APR cars, 6.50% APR other vehicles, federally insured by NCUA.
I think it's time for some news, because this has been a pretty big week for film news, because CinemaCon has been going on, which is the time when all of the studios essentially unveil what they've got coming up to distributors and try and make a big song and dance about how great their films are going to be, so that the distributors, or the exhibitors, I should say, book in as many screens as possible. So there was quite a lot of exciting news coming out. Let's start with something I alluded to at the very beginning of the show, which is the fact that they have cast someone as Aragorn. And that someone is Jamie Dornan.
I mean, clearly they saw him on SNL UK doing the Irish-themed pub, and we're like, that's our guy. Give him a sword. Because Aragorn loves sitting at the back of the pub, especially when he's Strider.
He does.
His whole thing.
And they're literally calling him Strider, if you notice, in this incarnation.
Yeah,
they seem to be hitting that pretty hard. I guess the idea being he hasn't yet come into his own as the future King of Gondor.
Does it also mean he's going to have a hood up and be in the shadows at the back of every shot so you can't see that it's not actually Viggo Mortensen?
I mean, possible. Mm. Do you think he's going to commit to not washing his hair for 6 months like Viggo Mortensen, or longer like Viggo did?
Did he do that?
I'm not sure he didn't. I'm not saying he's unclean or anything else, but he very much camped out, tried to sleep rough as much as possible, you know, sort of bathed in streams and tried to kind of get into character that way. I don't think he was obnoxious about it. I'm sure he wasn't smelly, but like he did try and live wild. Mm. So I don't know if Jamie Dornan will do that.
Right.
But I'm excited for this opportunity for him.
That feels like more of a Schmeagle move to just hole up, not shower, writhe around in the dirt, smash a couple of fish.
Hopefully not the writhing and the smashing. You know, that wouldn't be. If he's going to smash something, it should be a pair of doors.
Yes.
So
widely open.
Widely opened, yep.
Yeah. I'm taking a wait and see opposed to Viggo Mortensen. That's some very big shoes to fill. We shall see.
I have to say, though, I don't know about you guys. I'm very cautious about this whole endeavor and the combination of, you know, Ian McKellen's back, but they're going to have to de-age him because he's aged, as we all have since the original films.
Yeah, they aged him up in the original films a bit, so that helps somewhat. But yeah, it's 25 years or more.
And there are various other characters who, to an extent, they are going to have to do probably some digital de-aging, maybe a bit of makeup on the set as well. Then I would kind of prefer that they sort of recast these things, which maybe feels a bit sacrilegious because those original bits of casting are incredible. But I'm happier with Jamie Dornan doing it than Viggo coming back and being de-aged, which it sounds like is something where he was like, I just don't want to do that.
Yeah,
I think he was offered that choice.
I think they probably at least had a discussion with him out of politeness, right? Mm. They seem like the kind of people who would reach out and at least have the conversation, especially given that they've got, you know, Elijah back and they've got Ian back. I'm sure that they at least had a discussion with him. But I think, you know, Frodo will be maybe a bookend. Gandalf always disappears early on in an adventure and doesn't come back until the end. So that's probably what he's going to be doing here. But, you know, Aragorn or Strider, if we're going for that, is going to pretty much carry the film, presumably. He's the one who is hunting for Gollum, right? Mm. So de-aging to that degree for that amount of time, that would be not fun, I suspect, for anybody. And a huge, you know, addition to the budget. This wasn't the only piece of casting. They've also announced that Leo Woodall, who was being, you know, we knew he was having discussions about this. He's apparently going to be playing a character called Halvar. Now, I saw that name and I assumed he was an elf because I was getting him mixed up with Haldir, who's the elf who turns up at Helm's Deep.
Yeah.
That is not the case. He is, in fact, another ranger, apparently. I don't know if he's going to make it to the end of the film, guys, but fingers crossed for him.
And we have sort of confirmation that Kate Winslet is going to be some relation of Schmeagol.
We think, because her name ends in Gol.
Marigol.
So maybe flashback to Schmeagol and his mum kind of a thing, or Schmeagol and his sister, or Schmeagol and his other woman in his life. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But yeah, we don't really know anything other than her name. We do know that Lee Pace, the aforementioned, is going to be returning as the King of the Wood Elves.
Thranduil.
Yeah. I believe in my recollection of what happened when they were hunting for gold, I think they did get some help from the Wood Elves. And I think, I'm surprised that we're not hearing anything about Legolas, if I'm honest, because he and Aragorn already knew each other going into the Council of Elrond, right? Mm. And I thought he helped. But anyway, good stuff.
Nipped out to the shops.
He probably did, just at the wrong time. Mm-hmm. This film, does it need to exist? Maybe not, but let's hope it's good if it's gonna. You know?
Rings of Power is proof that sometimes if you expand the Lord of the Rings franchise, you can get some good stuff.
That's true. What else leapt out at you guys from CinemaCon? Anything you particularly want to get into?
Godzilla!
Godzilla minus zero, which is surely just Godzilla, right? If you're minusing zero, is that not just...
Godzilla. Yeah, very excited by this. Takashi Yamazaki is back, the writer, director, and VFX lead from Godzilla Minus One. And we've got a little teaser trailer. That's the main thing, the teaser trailer, which gives us a little bit more info about what the sequel is going to be. It's out later this year. It's out in like November.
Yeah.
So it's really not very far away. And we know it's set 2 years after Minus One. Godzilla has been bulking up. He pops out of the ocean in this trailer, and he is a beefy, beefy boy, and not just in the thigh department as he was in Minus One. Those were some. He was not skipping leg day.
No, absolutely not.
In the previous film, and now he's not skipping shoulder day either. And the main intriguing thing is that we have a brilliantly realized shot of Godzilla walking next to the Statue of Liberty, and it is brilliantly framed. So this tells us that Godzilla is going to be in New York, and initially it looks like Godzilla is smaller than the Statue of Liberty because of the angle of it, and then it very quickly becomes clear that he is huge, way, way, way bigger.
So it's not that he was small, it's just he was far away.
He was far away.
Ah.
Perspective, like they used on Lord of the Rings to make the hobbits look tiny. a few details for now, but details to be very excited about. They are holding back on the possibility of additional monsters, but I very much imagine that we may be getting some King Ghidorah in this mix, which would be very exciting.
Cool. And this is shot for IMAX, right?
Shot for IMAX, yeah. It sounds like they're going bigger in many ways than they did on Minus One, which was a very big film for Japan as a production. But obviously after that success and Oscar wins, they are going bigger in many ways. It sounds like a fair amount of the story involves America and still Japan as well, but a slightly more international focus, shot for IMAX, and they have sort of nebulously spoken about how, you know, obviously a lot of the chat on Minus One was how incredible it was that they made that film for roughly $15 million. Yeah. From what I heard when I spoke to the director, I think it was actually quite a bit less than that even. His sort of answer was along the lines of, I wish it had $15 million. This one, I think they have a lot more than $15 million, and so hopefully we get to see some big crashy bashy from...
Love a bit of big crashy bashy. Sorry, that's a different tune. I also enjoyed the trailer for Focker-in-Law, which I was not previously hyped about, if I'm honest. But actually, I think where they're going with it is kind of... intriguing. So the idea is that Ariana Grande's sort of fiance to the hapless Skylar Gisondo, because if you need hapless, I feel like he's the guy you call. And she is potentially manipulative, potentially evil, at least in Ben Stiller's eyes, and trying to consciously uncouple his son from his overbearing parenting. And I think that's quite a fun premise for this.
And I think it's fun as well that obviously the dynamic in the originals is that Ben Stiller feels woefully inadequate next to Robert De Niro. Mm-hmm. And so then the extra complication of Ariana Grande here is that actually she gets on really well with Robert De Niro, which only serves to make Ben Stiller look worse. And so to continue that dynamic of Ben Stiller's character, the fucker, being the sort of butt of all the jokes and being the one who is made to look just the worst. Yep. They've kept that intact without him having to become the De Niro character in that dynamic. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's like
an interesting
twist on it.
I think it's a fun time. Yeah,
I haven't seen the trailer, but you have successfully sold me on it. So
that was our point. Yes. At the other sort of, it wasn't a trailer; it was more of an announcement. Was for Spaceballs, the new one. Now, those of us who are fans of the original Spaceballs know that the sequel was due to be called The Search for More Money. And what we learn in this little announcement from Mel Brooks is that he found the money. Apparently it was in his basement. So he doesn't need to search for it anymore. So they're just calling it Spaceballs, the new one. I don't know if that's better or worse, if I'm honest, but I'm still very hyped that we're going to get it.
Yeah.
And see what's happening.
I have to say, I'm Spaceballs agnostic. I've never seen the original. And I don't know. It's possibly not my favorite style of comedy.
Okay.
I don't know.
That kind of silly spoof.
Yeah, sometimes I like that, sometimes I don't. It sounds like they have a lot of material for this one. Again, reports out of CinemaCon. Obviously, they have an entire sequel trilogy's worth of Star Wars to riff on, and Avatar, and various other massive sci-fi franchises that have happened in the meantime. So hopefully, you know, Mel Brooks and a lot of material to work with means fans should be happy.
I think so. I think there's material there that nobody has really spoofed yet, you know, particularly. So as long as they don't go, I don't know, back to the same sort of bullet time well that everybody made fun of for about 5 years there, I think we should be onto a good thing. Anything else that you wanted to talk about?
One trailer that we have all just seen is the new trailer for Street Fighter, which was really fun. Honestly, between Street Fighter and Mortal Kombat, it just feels like my childhood is on screen this summer. It's so fun. But yeah, a lot of fun. A lot of, if you play the games, you'll recognize a lot of the characters, a lot of the special moves. Andrew Koji, I think he's playing Ryu, which means that there's going to be a lot of really cool fight choreography just because he's there, which I'm excited about. So yeah, fun, ridiculous. 50 Cent is in the cast for some reason. I don't know.
Noah Centineo and a blonde hairdo. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Got a couple of wrestlers in there, Cody Rhodes, as Guile, and Roman Reigns, can't remember who he's playing, but yeah, could be fun. It's probably going to be very ridiculous, but should be fun.
Seems like they're leaning into the video gaminess and embracing the character designs and the outlandish world that it's set in. Amon basically exploded at the Hadouken at the end.
That's the fireball?
It's the big fireball. It's the special move. Yeah. And it makes you realize how many things from Street Fighter have kind of permeated in the culture. Yeah. Even the perfect sort of sound effect that has, you know, found a life way beyond that game pops up in the trailer a couple
has
of times
it?
As well.
Yeah. Where has it found a life?
In a lot of music.
Oh, okay.
A lot of hip-hop music. They'll use that as like a sort of percussive ad lib.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I am aware of Street Fighter. I have seen
Street Fights.
Are you more familiar with Mortal Kombat or Street Fighter?
I'm more familiar, I think, with Street Fighter, but I'm not familiar with either. I don't have any horse in this fight or race.
There actually might be a horse in one of these fights.
Yeah, I mean, it seems possible. I know enough to appreciate that they have kept the looks very close to the looks in the sort of the 8-bit games and everything else. I do think I will struggle to care. So I'm excited to see if they can give me any reason to care about any of these people. Maybe the Andrew Koji character based on what we saw in the trailer, but I didn't care about anyone else in what we've seen so far. So that's going to be exciting for me, I guess.
We also had some cool casting news. Adria Arjona was at CinemaCon to promote the Thomas Crown Affair, which I'm very excited for. But more pertinently for this discussion, she has been cast in Man of Tomorrow, which is shooting next week, as Maxima, who is an alien who comes to Earth looking to find a suitable mate, and she has her eyes fixed on Superman. So that is the character she is playing.
Do we think this is a double bluff and she's been cast as Wonder Woman?
I don't know, but if that is the case, then that would make me more hyped for her, honestly. I would like her more as that character, purely because I think that means that she is in the DCU for longer, and I think she would be a great Wonder Woman. But I guess we'll see.
She's like ludicrously talented and insanely charismatic, obviously, between Andor and Hitman and, Blink Twice. She was great in Blink Twice as well. Like, she is dynamite on screen, so that is a very exciting piece of casting.
Yeah. I mean, look, this is not to say she won't be good as Maxima if that is what they're doing, and I'm sure they'll find something fun to do with that, but I don't know. I just got a bit suspicious. They've announced, I think that this was already rumored, but it was on the slate announcement that Game of Thrones, Aegon's Conquest is on Warner Brothers' to-do list. So that's happening. There's going to be a new Long Legs as well.
Yeah.
What do
I'm
we think about this?
Intrigued by this. So another Long Legs film, Nicolas Cage is going to be back. Osgood Perkins is going to be back as writer-director. I'm not sure about this personally. Long Legs, I think, is a film that has maybe slightly cooled in people's estimation since it came out. Obviously, Osgood Perkins has been very prolific over the last few years. Mm-hmm. He went straight from Long Legs to The Monkey to Keeper. He has another one that I think is already shot that is out before the end of the year. And Long Legs, obviously, I think became a little bit of a victim of its own hype because of the sheer level of, it's the scariest movie ever made. Mm. And actually, that film is doing some interesting, strange tonal things, but it's not going for scariest movie ever made. So I'm intrigued of what a second Long Legs film is, especially if it's centering around Nicolas Cage doing that crazy Nicolas Cage thing he does.
Yeah.
I don't quite know where people are at temperature-wise on Osgood Perkins yet. I don't know if they can recapture that hype or if people are ready for more Long Legs, if that's something people want, but it's happening. Hopefully he has an interesting idea.
That scariest movie ever made tagline that gets attached to a lot of horror films lately. I'm just trying to think of the last time it was actually that was actually said, and I fully agreed with it after I watched the film, because it happened with Barbarian. And that film...
That was scary.
To me, I mean, I personally thought that was overhyped and it wasn't that scary to me. I know me saying that is insane, but that is how I felt.
Also, Zach Cregger, another director who is always going for more interesting things than just the scariest thing.
Absolutely. And I actually think Aunt Gladys owes a little bit to Long Legs. I feel like just the extremeness of that look.
People have also said scariest movie ever... with Lee Cronin's The Mummy, and we'll get into it, but I'm not sure if it's...
Well, that. I think somebody at the intro to the movie said I'm not sure.
Many people were saying that before.
Is that influencers, though? Is that one of the reasons they invite influencers? Because they say things like, scariest movie ever?
Those tags of, like, it's the scariest movie ever comes primarily from social media, and it's you know, embraced by the studios as part of the campaign, because why wouldn't they?
Of course,
it's
going
to drive people out to cinemas, but that's part of the ecosystem that is currently driving all of this. But I think I think it's biting a lot of films as they release, and Long Legs, I think, was a bit of a victim of that.
Yeah.
Can I talk about my favorite headline out of CinemaCon really quickly?
Okay.
The Beekeeper 2... will follow the Beekeeper Society trying to overthrow the US government. Jason Statham also now uses bees to heal his wounds. Can we just wrap it up and give it the Best Picture Oscar right now? This is amazing.
Bees heal wounds?
Well, I mean, honey technically is antiseptic or anti-something.
Does it just mean he uses Burt's Bees products? Skincare.
I mean, they're very nice skincare. Mm. You know, other
Jason
skincare
Statham,
is available.
Good skin.
Jason Statham aging well. Do you know what I mean?
Okay. It's all the bees.
I don't know if I'm 100% sold on that sort of theory. I mean, look, if somebody wants to overthrow the U.S. government, with bees. I'm intrigued to see that, I suppose.
Wait, so are the bees overthrowing the government, but also helping Jason Statham?
The Beekeeper Society is overthrowing the US government.
Okay. Right. Okay. So, I look forward to watching this on a plane.
Yeah, I guess. It's a lot. I don't know. I'm just now having visions of Nicolas Cage again going, not the bees.
Not the bees.
Good luck to him. Good luck to the beekeepers. I'm excited to see it. I'm sure there was more out of CinemaCon and will have been more by the time you listen to this.
I feel like the most important one we should briefly mention is Spider-Verse.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah. A couple of images, right?
Yeah.
Four images.
And they're going for an almost like IMAX style aspect ratio on this one. They're going like big, tall screen. Yes, Amon has the actual ratio that I did not bother to look up. I'm like, it's a tall picture. But very cool. Yeah, we've got a first handful of images. I think they showed footage in the room at CinemaCon, but they at least gave us plebs a smattering of delicious images that look very, very cool. And there's a really cool Spider-Punk one in particular that is just like showing how they're going to use that expanded frame in a very interesting way, as they do in these films. Everything in the frame in a Spider-Verse film is something worth looking at. So that's
very cool. I'm excited about this. And it sounds like what took the time is that when they decided to make a third film, they had too much for one film, but not enough for two films. Mm. So they basically had to create the full middle act of this film from nothing. Mm. And that's why we've had to wait since 2023. Not that we're bitter.
I've been saying for the last 4 years, you are on the verge of a 15-star trilogy. Take your time, land the plane. We will wait.
Well, okay, but also, could they not land the plane quicker too? Like, can we not have both?
But then once the plane's landed, we have the plane forever. So if they land the plane as safely as possible, then we have a better plane for
the future.
Why
do we want a plane unless it's taken off again? Come on, think it through.
Because it's full of snacks and movies. Ooh. Like The Beekeeper 2.
I feel like that's somehow slagging off Spider-Verse, beyond the Spider-Verse, but okay. Yeah, look, I'm thrilled. Can't wait to see it. It's going to be amazing. And much more news, I'm sure, to come from CinemaCon, but yes, well done, everyone. Shall we move on? Shall we have an interview?
Let's do it.
Yeah.
Yes. So this week, we are delighted to be joined by Brian Cox, who is, of course, the star of Succession, Troy, X-Men 2, you name it, as well as finding time to be a completely different person who knows a lot about physics, which is pretty impressive. So this week, he's making his directorial debut in Glenrothen, which is, I mean, he may well have made it in a place called Glenrothen, but also it's a film called Glenrothen, which is a family drama, comedy, whatever, in which he also stars as Sandy, who's the owner of a Scottish distillery who has to reckon with his past regrets when his estranged brother, Donal, who's played by Alan Cumming, comes back to town. And we sent Chris along to speak to Brian Cox because we couldn't go an entire episode without Chris, of course. So here is Chris talking to Brian Cox. Please enjoy.
Brian, this is the Empire Podcast.
Yes.
We can talk about whatever you want to talk about. You can swear if you want to swear.
Oh, okay.
There are no restrictions.
Fuck this. Fuck this for a game of fucking soldiers. I'm not fucking doing it any fucking more.
And off he pops. We've lost Brian Cox. He's gone.
Yeah, it's like giving whiskey to the proverbial to tell me that I can swear. Because I do swear, and I never used to swear. Well, I swore a bit, but I never swear as much as I swear now.
Why is that?
Logan fucking Roy, that's what it is. That's what did it for me.
Oh, interesting. Okay, interesting. So that's something that they didn't title that for you then? You swore as a result of Logan Roy. Logan Roy didn't swear as a result of you.
No, not at all. I mean, he was swearing all the time, you know.
Yeah.
And I read the script and try to do the lines that are in the script. So I was fucking off on a regular basis.
Well, welcome to the Motherfucking Empire Podcast, Brian
Cox.
Right,
that's fine. I'm so fucking happy to be here.
Very, very happy to have you here. here, sir. This is your directorial debut, Glenn Rothen.
It is.
What took you so long? What kept you?
Nothing kept me because I never wanted to do it. It wasn't my idea. It was Neil Zeiger, fuck him's idea. I can say that, can't I? That's good. It was his fucking idea. He came to me and he said, you're directing this film. And I said, what? So you're going to be directing this, David Ashton, who we're all friends. We're all way back.
Yeah.
And he said, you're directing David's film. I said, what do you mean I'm directing David's film? He said, well, you're going to direct it. I said, how, why? And he said, well, you know, you're going to direct it. That's it. You're going to direct it. And I said, well, and it was force majeure. So I was forced to direct it. So I thought, okay, well, I'm going to direct it. And I thought, it's okay because I would have probably played Sandy even if I hadn't directed it. I'd probably end up playing Sandy anyway, which is a good part, actually. So I said, okay, fine, so I'm directing it. But it was a tremendous experience because of, you know, having been part of films for a long time, you know, I've done over 200 movies, and having worked with some of the most awful directors of all time, you know, I mean, real control freaks, and sort of stuck in a kind of way. I mean, not everybody. I mean, there's some really wonderful directors.
You've worked with some crackers as well.
I've worked with some really great directors, so I can't complain. But the bulk of them sometimes is that they're all sort of concept ridden, you know, and you go, and I'm not interested in that. I'm only interested in exercising the talent of the people I'm working with and to do it on an egalitarian basis so that everybody contributes what they need to contribute. And I don't stand in their way. I said, you want to design the sets for this? You design the sets. And I will stand by you, you know. And so they did what they wanted to do. Mm-hmm. So that means everybody's happy. And I was fine because I just think you've got to marshal the talent and not impede the talent. You must marshal it and say, let it go. Do ahead. Go ahead. And I don't think there's nearly enough of that done because we don't trust. You know, we're still so untrustworthy as a species. And I find that I have to operate on a different level altogether.
And with actors, I mean, the performances in this are fantastic.
Yeah.
Was it a case of direct unto others as you would have others direct unto you?
Absolutely. And also the fact that these are actors who know what they're doing.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, you don't have to direct an actress like Shirley Henderson. You just have to give her the space. And she'll blast you out of the room. You know, she's just wonderful. And it's the same with Alan. Alan is a really considerable actor.
Yeah.
And you just allow him, and that's what I love about this film. It's getting back to what Alan really does best. I mean, he plays these creatures, and he's brilliant at traitors and things like that. But that's not the Alan Cumming I know. The Alan Cumming I know is this really rather profound actor. And he does some wonderful stuff. And I think he's fabulous in the film.
Yeah, I was watching this. And we've had Alan on the show over the years as well, and he's wonderful to talk to.
Yeah.
But there's something about, I don't know, the way that Hollywood, I think in particular, has kind of pigeonholed him a little bit. So when I watched Glenn Rothen, I was like, oh my God, there's so many more strings to this man's bow.
Yes, exactly.
Than I think people have allowed him to display.
That was my point. You know, that you know, originally when we started 100 years ago thinking about the film, I thought we'd have an American actor because the fact that he'd gone for nearly 40 years
and the accent might have changed.
He'd become Americanized and everything. And I went down that route for a while, but then most of the American actors I talked to didn't understand what I was implying. You know, they couldn't. Why? What do you mean? Why can't I? Well, I said, no, it's all right, fine, forget it. You know, we won't go there. But Alan, of course, and I suddenly thought, it's got to be Alan Cumming. It has to be Alan. You know, it was, you know, his name was on the part all the time.
How far back do you and Alan go? Because obviously you were in X-Men 2 together 23 years ago.
I first saw Alan in probably 1984.
Right.
When he left drama school. I can't remember when he left drama school, but one of the earliest things he did was, he did a production of Tartuffe, and he was playing the son. He wasn't even playing one of the major roles.
Okay.
But he was unforgettable. And I just thought, who is this young man with this phenomenal energy and this focus, which was quite startling? And it was Alan. And I've watched Alan over the years become a really, truly wonderful actor. But also, there's this other side of him, which people have naturally employed because he loves it. I mean, he loves the whole thing. And traitors as a result of all that, you know.
But, yeah, but you get to sing in this as well. So there's a little bit of singing going on.
Yeah, with Alan, it's always difficult because he can really sing, you know.
You have to stop Alan singing.
Yes. Well, no, I had to get him singing because, you know, he sings that wonderful version of, you know, we had these two, Tommy and Roddy, who are our composers, were just fantastic. And Tommy wrote this version of My Heart's in the Highlands, which is, you know, it just makes me cry every time I hear it. You know, I get very moved by that. You know.
I was just reminded the other day that you and Alan had actually done carpool karaoke.
We did carpool karaoke together. Yes.
Together.
You know, but I shall never forgive him for that.
Why is that?
Because I had to sing a Spice Girls song, and it was fucking embarrassing. I mean, truly fucking embarrassing. And I said, do we have to sing? No, it's all part of it, Brian. We've got to sing this. I said, you know, what do you want? What is it? What do you really, tell me what you want, what you really want. I thought, oh, this is fucking atrocious. But I did it with a wonderfully bad grace.
I'm a Shakespearean actor for the love of Christ.
Yes, exactly.
I can't be doing this.
That cuts no ice whatsoever. That just brings out the cruel people.
The cruel people.
They come out and say, oh yeah, you can sing that. That would be great.
So I guess you made sure never to get into a car with Alan on the way to set,
just in case he sprung something on you. No, he doesn't. He only does it professionally. He doesn't do it any other way.
So when you think about it, we were just saying that you have been directed by some clunkers in your life, but also some crackers.
Yeah.
You know, Michael Mann is someone that you were directed
by. It's, actually, ironically, it's the end of this month is the 40th anniversary of Manhunter.
My God.
I know. I can't believe it.
Has anyone come out and asked you to...
Well, there was a talk.
To do something.
I may not be available. That's the only problem because I'm about to start this Dexter show, which I'm doing. You know, I'm playing a retired serial killer.
Well, I'm guessing Hannibal Lecter then. Was he your first serial killer?
I think he was. Yeah. Yes, I didn't do one before that. No.
Yeah. 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 So 40 years on from Manhunter, how do you look back on that experience?
I loved it. I still think it's the best film about that character.
Yeah.
Because I don't do any of that Welsh business. I play it straight down the line. Because I went to school with these guys.
Yeah.
I know what these guys are like. You know, I went to the guys, a couple of guys who are now doing life in prison for murder, you know.
This is in Dundee.
In Dundee. So I knew those kids. I knew them. I knew what that was like. And I knew what that mentality was about, that sort of determination that they have. And of course, you put it into a sort of psychiatrist, it's doubly dangerous, you know.
Jesus. So, you know, when you think about the great directors you work with, would Michael Mann be up there? I mean, who else would be on your list?
Lindsay Anderson.
Oh my God.
Without question. A wonderful director who ran the Royal Exchange in Manchester called Michael Elliott.
Yes.
Who's a fantastic director and whose daughter is Marianne Elliott, who was actually my assistant when I directed Richard III in Regent's Park 25 years ago. And she was my assistant. She's now become those. Again, she's taken over her father's talent, you know, because tragically he died at the age of 53. He had dwarf kidneys, and he was in a very bad way. But the last thing I did with him was Moby Dick, and it was probably one of the most sensational things I've ever done, really.
What separates a great director from a merely good director for you?
A great director is a visionary, is that he gives you things that you never even thought about. And when you tells you them, it makes complete sense, male or female. And I've, you know, the other great director I work with is Deborah Warner, who creates the most wonderful working atmosphere and lets things grow in the rehearsal. So many directors come with their ideas and what they want to do, you know, and I think that's unorganic. I think you have to work with the people that you work with. And this is what I learned about doing Glenn Rothen. Let the people who are there serve their particular talent and don't get in the way. Let them do it and let them offer what they can offer. And usually it's harmonious. usually it is a sense of togetherness of all of us working together. And I believe in that. I really believe that's the most important element in any creative activity, especially any group creative activity.
So what were you keen to not do as a director? What mistakes were you keen to avoid?
Tell people what to do.
Yeah.
Never told anybody what to do. I let them do what they did. And, you know, and I would sort of suggest things, but never ever alter what their initial relationship to that particular text was as an actor or an actress. Mm. You know, when you work with somebody like Shirley Henderson and Alan, when you work with somebody like Shirley Henderson, you just stand back and let her go. And she is phenomenal. She is phenomenal. You know, because she's very pure. Shirley, she's a very pure, rather brilliant actress, and you just allow that to be, you know, and don't stand it, don't get in the way. That's the thing a director mustn't do. Don't get in the way of the talent. Yeah. Let the talent thrive, you know.
So how did you tackle camera work and working with and composing shots and
well,
things like that?
Well, you know, you've got to get a great DP. And I work with this Jamie Aykroyd, who is Barry Aykroyd's son.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Ironically, I worked with Barry, and I did a film with Rafe Fiennes, Coriolanus, which I think is a wonderful film, but it's Rafe doesn't get his just desserts for that. And I had a great time, you know, working with seeing and observing Barry, how Barry worked. Now, Jamie is a stylist. He's not like his father. He's taken a different route. Mm. And he's a brilliant stylist. And I saw some of his work and I said, I think this boy will do. And he does. I mean, he makes Scotland look like incredible. You know, he really does make Scotland look beautiful, stunning. Yeah. And that's down to Jamie.
There's an interesting tension in the film, because obviously you're very, very proud to be Scottish. Alan's character has been self-exiled from Scotland for a long, long time. He has a very complicated relationship
very
with Scotland.
Complicated.
It's something
very
that he's shut out of his mind, but he still loves the country.
Yeah.
You know, you've moved away as well from Scotland, but I know you try and get back there as often as you can. What's your relationship like with Scotland?
It's a complicated one, quite frankly. It really is complicated because of the level of poverty that still exists in Scotland. And we haven't been able to shift it, particularly child poverty. You know, and I find that really kind of acutely depressing. And and also the way we are treated as, you know, I mean, I'm going to be repeating myself, but, you know, these people have heard it before. But the telephone. Alexander Graham Bell, a Scot.
Yeah.
John Logie Baird, television, a Scot. Hmm. Anesthesia, Simpson.
Yeah.
You know, these were what we've contributed, what my nation has contributed to the general good.
Not to mention golf.
Not to mention golf. Somebody mentioned golf the other day. I don't play golf. I'm with Sam Clements. It's a good walk spoiled as far as I'm concerned on golf. You know, I cannot do little balls and holes. I mean, snooker, golf, any of that stuff, I just die. I think, oh, for fuck's sake, let's get out of here now.
And you call yourself a Scot, Brian.
No, it's not. Golf is it's not, you know, everybody plays it now, but it was a wee bit of a posh game, you know. It's like, you know, everybody in their place, which is one thing I cannot stand, you know. I mean, I'm a socialist and I don't believe in that, you know. I don't believe in all that, you know, I'm the boss and you're not, you know, all that stuff.
What's your sport of choice if you have a sport then?
Well, I do like football.
Yeah.
I really love football. And I've always been a Man United fan because...
Well, this interview's over. Thanks, Brian. Thanks for coming in.
I've always been a Man United fan, but of course they've been through a rather bad time. And they're getting better. They're getting better. But also, I'm aware of other teams. And the team that I really do admire is Arsenal. And that's my son. He's my youngest son has become an Arsenal fan, so he took me to the Arsenal games. And I think Saka is probably one of the great players of all time. That young, that number seven is just amazing. What he can do is, I mean, and he doesn't do it with any fuss. He just does it. He just plays the game. And I watch him dribble and I think, he's incredible, that guy. He's absolutely incredible.
He is phenomenal. I will admit that. I'm a Liverpool fan. Well,
there you go. Well, but, Liverpool, of course, when the great Scottish people were running Liverpool, it was a great team.
Very much so. Yeah. Shankly, Dalglish.
Great people. You know. Yeah. But you always need a good Scot to run the teams. Busby did it in Manchester. When you know, think of Busby, he came to Manchester just after the war, and it was a mess. It was a complete mess. The ground was a mess. It had been bombed. You know all that, and he built that team up. And of course, I still remember the Munich air disaster. I was a boy then, and it was one of the saddest days ever. You know, Duncan Edwards, who was I can remember him. Yeah. As this beautiful player, and this young man who was, you know, who died as a result of that crash.
Yeah, gone far too early. Brian, I've got to let you go, but just very quickly, the fact that you didn't mention Dundee or Dundee United, does that speak to that complicated relationship with Scotland as well? Are we going back to that?
No, it's bipartisan.
Okay.
I cannot go for one team as opposed to the other. That would be wrong of me, because they're both two teams that are, you know, they have their moments and they've been great. My cousin Bobby Cox played for Dundee. He was a right back, and he also played for Scotland as well. When any team was ever picked, I was the one they always said, well, I suppose we'll have to have Cox.
I was the same. Pick last.
And you don't ever forget that.
You don't. You
know, it cripples you for life.
The wound runs deep.
The wound runs so deep. I suppose we'll have to have Cox.
Absolutely.
You know, and I just, I mean, but to watch that game, it is the beautiful game, and I love the game.
Absolutely. Well, listen, Brian, on that note, I could talk to you for a lot longer, but I've got to let you go. We haven't sworn in about 15 minutes, so I'm going to say, Brian Cox, thanks for fucking coming in.
Oh, thank you for fucking having me.
Pleasure.
All right, that was Brian Cox talking to Chris about Glenn Rothen, which we'll be talking about in a couple of minutes. But let's start with the biggest release, I think, of the week, which is Lee Cronin's The Mummy.
Yes.
Amon, as a fellow scaredy cat, set it up for us.
Yes. So we have Emily Mitchell as a young Katie. She is the daughter of a journalist played by Jack Rayner and a nurse played by Laya Costa. And she is kidnapped. And then 8 years later, she is found. But there's something a little off with her. But the doctors say that all she needs is some family time. That's all she needs.
It turns out
she needs a little bit more than that. This has three core elements to it. It's got body horror. It's got a domestic marital situation. And it's got a mystery to it. And I think it scores on all three. The body horror, there are things that are done to fingernails and toenails in this movie that will stay with me for quite some time.
It was fun. We all saw this last night in a pretty packed house.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And a toenail scene.
Pedicure scene, yeah.
A complete whole audience. All at the same time, which is a joyous.
So on the body horror, it scores. Domestic situation, the marital stuff, I think really, really works. There is some lingering trauma, of course, after the kidnapping that is not always made explicit, but there's always just underneath the surface. Mm. I think they act that really well. And then the mystery, which is, I guess, the point person for that is Mae Kalamaui, who plays Detective Dahlia Zaki. And it's really, really compelling. I was always interested in her determination to try to figure this out. This mystery at the heart of everything. And it's also through her, I mean, there's punishing sound design all the way through, but the sound design that really sticks out to me, at one point she fires her gun. It is the loudest gunshot I have heard in a cinema in quite some time. I was thinking, how can a gun that small make a sound that big?
I think also in that screen, they really cranked up the sound.
They really did. So there's only two things that had quibbles about. Like, as I say, I don't think this is the scariest movie of the year. I think it's very nasty and gruesome, but it's not always very scary, although there are times when I had to look away from the screen. And there's also the editing at times is a little bit off. There were sequences that happen, and they do a good job of sort of setting up the geography of the house. But there's sequences that happen there, the characters going through it upstairs, And then there's characters who are unawares about
having
what's happening downstairs.
Nice little quiet chat. And you think,
I think you have to assume that that house has some serious, like it's Adobe, I guess, and that doesn't really, you know, allow sound to travel well. But the other option is it's either that or it's supernatural sound muffling. That's the only thing that makes sense for me in those moments.
But I still find it to be very compelling. I don't like to use the word enjoy when it comes to horror films, but it's very compelling, very effective.
Do you know, I did find this quite a fun time though, because I am a fan of Lee Cronin's work. I really liked Evil Dead Rise, but the trailers for this, for Lee Cronin's The Mummy.
Yeah, I think that's for copyright reasons, right? Just to distinguish it from the Universal.
Yeah, it feels like, in a way, it's quite funny because truly, I say this as a fan of him, nobody knows who Lee Cronin is. But at the same time, even just as a signaling of like, this is an authored film, this is not a franchise thing, this is an authored piece of work. And it does feel very Lee Cronin. If you liked Evil Dead Rise, I think you will like this film.
I agree.
Why do I think there'll still be people showing up to the cinemas wondering, why isn't Brendan Fraser in this? What's going on?
They are in.
Give us a little bit of time. Give us a little bit of time.
Because this is very gnarly. But the filmmaking in it, I think, is generally really good. This man loves a split diopter shot more than anything in the world.
Oh my gosh,
and he maybe very slightly overdoes them in this one, because every shot involving Katie, she's doing something freaky in the foreground, and you have a split diopter and you have somebody else looking freaked out in the background.
Yeah.
But you can really feel the intention he's put into a lot of this. I found it a slightly strange mix of, on the one hand, it does feel very familiar because you can look at all of the horror beats and go, that's The Exorcist, that's The Omen, that's Evil Dead. At the same time, to have those influences tied up in the guise of a mummy film feels new. So it kind of feels new, but kind of familiar at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't much here that I felt like I'd never seen, but I've never seen it done as this kind of horror, this like supernatural mummy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I thought he had a real commitment to the family, which I liked. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was really interesting. And I think it's particularly interesting in the very last minutes of the film that I'm obviously not going to get into.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was quite effective because I think it leavens the awful stuff that's going on elsewhere. I mean, this family are being put through it. Mm-hmm. And the commitment to having a family who at their heart love each other and care for each other, is just enough to kind of get you through this endurance test. So I like that. I think it's very Evil Dead. And I think, if anything, I would have liked to have a bit more mummy-ishness about it. And obviously, the curses aren't real, so it's hard to know what that would be. But I feel like there's something else we could have maybe done, because this feels very much more based in changeling myths in Irish mythology, or like possession myths in European mythology, and not specifically in Egypt. And I think some of the portrayal of Egypt may rub some people up the wrong way. And I would kind of understand that. I think Meg Hallamawi is brilliant in this, and I really, really liked her character and what she gets to do, because I thought that was really effective. But I think some of the other Egyptian stuff may cause some people to be troubled, let us say.
Mm-hmm. I need to check with you guys, because I haven't spoken to you about this yet. I was sat on the same row as both of you, quite a bit further down the row from you two. The opening sequence to this is very spooky. There are spooky shenanigans happening. Mm-hmm. And there was a big jump scare early on, and I'm pretty sure I saw a Helen shape leap out of a chair, truly to a physical extent that I very rarely see in the cinema. It brought me so much joy. I think, did you like
I don't know if I left my skin, but I definitely, I was scared. I was properly scared. I have reservations about some aspects of this film. I think we gave it 3 stars. I would agree with that. I don't think it's a 5-star masterpiece or anything. I think Evil Dead Rise is better than this, but I was proper scared.
That particular moment got me good.
Some of that, I mean, and that was throughout. Like if I wasn't being jump scared, and there's some like big like sound jump scares, there's a lot of gore scares. Mm. There's a lot of slow burn tension. To me, it's a very, very scary film. He is throwing everything at the wall, but sometimes I would have liked maybe it to be like a little bit more focused and a little bit more narrowed down to what really works. Mm. It is a long film too for horror. It's over 2 hours. And I think, again, you could have tightened that up a little bit without losing, some sense of a slow burn. So we gave it 3 stars, which is a recommendation, but certainly not for anyone with a weak stomach.
Mm.
Don't maybe eat immediately before you go in. or immediately afterwards, if I'm honest. And yeah, if you have young children, it may be more traumatic for you than for other people. So do bear that in mind as well. But 3 stars for Lee Cronin's The Mummy. Also out in cinemas this week is Rebuilding, which is a Josh O'Connor starring kind of cowboy story, right?
That is correct. He plays Dusty. And after wildfires destroy his ranch, he winds up in a FEMA camp and he finds community with others. And he also reconnects with his daughter and ex-wife. I'm just going to say right off the bat, there's something that just feels right about Josh O'Connor in a cowboy hat framed with this picturesque background. I mean, there's many, many shots of this, but it feels right. Would you agree?
I mean, weirdly, yes, but he's like, even though he's very English and very much not a cowboy in real life, he plays it really well. He does.
This is a very tender, gentle, heartwarming story that I really, really liked. It's slow-paced, but it was very deeply felt to me. I never felt bored. I was never really looking at my watch. There are times when you're watching a slow-paced film and that's kind of the energy it's giving. This is not giving that energy at all. And yeah, Josh O'Connor, very versatile. I think his most recent performance that I like the best is still in Wake Up Dead Man.
Sure.
But this is right behind it for me. I think he's great. Really liked Amy Madigan as his mother-in-law, Bess. And I like that this is really at the heart about community and about resilience. Those two things really come to the community, especially with people sharing what little they have with others.
Yeah.
And that's a film that we could use a lot more of in these times.
Absolutely. So. Great performance as well from Lily Latour as his daughter, Kelly Rose, who's a fantastic little actress, and Megan Fahey, very good as his ex-wife as well. This is written and directed by Max Walker Silverman.
And inspired by his own story.
Yeah, and I didn't know that actually, but that's really, really lovely, warm, as you say, film. Very gentle to the point where, you know, barely there. I think it's very, very slight, but it's a nice time, and especially like you could double bill this with The Mummy, like come out of The Mummy and then go into this and have your faith in humanity restored.
It is good.
You know, it's that kind of like, oh, okay, maybe sometimes things will be all right. So we don't have an official Empire review yet at the time of recording. I think for me, this would probably be a high 3. Mon, what do you think?
High 3, low 4.
High 3, okay. So somewhere in there. So again, recommendation, good film, but just be prepared for the kind of movie, I guess, that it is. Shall we go to Outcome? Ben, you want to set this one up quickly?
Yeah, this is the new film from Jonah Hill, his second feature as director in a sort of fictional capacity. He previously made Mid-90s, which I really liked, and the documentary he made about his therapist was his last film. Mm-hmm. He's been through a lot since then. Maybe some not so shiny allegations about him from people in his life. And he's come back with what I have to say is one of my least favorite genres of films, which is somewhat cancelled person makes a film about being cancelled. So it stars Keanu Reeves as Reef Hawk, who is a beloved movie star. The entire world loves him. He does franchises, but he also wins Oscars. He has been out of the game for a while.
Excuse me, Ben, sorry. You forgot to mention this two-time Oscar winner.
Two-time Oscar winner.
Got to mention it, please.
I said Oscar winner. Yes, call back to the movie. So he is about to make a bit of a comeback, having been away for years, secretly hiding issues with substances and his recovery from that. But his agent receives basically a bit of blackmail saying, we have an incriminating video of you. And so he sets about reconnecting with people in his life who he may have wronged, in some ways to apologize, but mainly to root out, like, what is this video? Who has it? What's on it? Where's it come from? And so the film is like effectively a sort of apology tour, and yet it's a cynical apology tour because it's motivated by what is the video and who can I,
how can I find it
and how can I squash it? And the film is, I have to say, an uncomfortable watch of, like, it seems to be Jonah Hill in some ways addressing what he has been through in these years. And it is like a semi-apology, but also a semi, like, woe is me. It sucks to be a celebrity. And like, everybody thinks they have something on you. And
it doesn't feel like it's particularly digging deep into that idea emotionally.
Yeah.
The weird thing is Keanu Reeves is a generally affable, likable Keanu Reeves in the main role, but Jonah Hill is also in this as Reef's crisis lawyer, playing a very, very over-the-top comedy character who I found excruciatingly irritating.
I hated him so much.
He looks mad. Everything about him is wacky, and he's just like a really over-the-top caricature, and the whole thing is just a tonal oddity. But it has like a weird psychedelic visual style. It's full of celebrities. Martin Scorsese is in this.
He's great.
He's so good. Yeah. He plays the first guy who recognized Reef's talent when he was a little kid. Mm. And so Reef reconnects with him and they have a really nice conversation in a bowling alley that is like the best scene in the film. Mm. The rest of it, I don't know. It just feels weirdly motivated. It didn't sit right with me.
No.
In the big picture of things, and also just as a viewing experience. It's on Apple TV Plus. It's about 70-75 minutes, but it kind of dragged even so, and also felt too slight. It's just a miss for me, and it's a shame because mid-90s I thought was excellent.
I really like Keanu in this. I genuinely think he really identifies with this idea of I've been famous and it has warped my life in some ways. I think that felt like there was something true there, but I hated pretty much everything else about it. And I should have been on board because, like, you've got Cameron Diaz in there and, you know,
Matt Bomer
as his best friends and really good people. But yeah, I think my hatred of the Jonah Hill character, and in particular, one scene about victimhood, turned me off this entire movie. But Keanu, as ever, is innocent. Yeah, I didn't love it.
Me neither.
Yeah.
I share your hatred of the Jonah Hill character. Did not work for me pretty much instantaneously, and that energy was maintained throughout. Because I agree with you in that Keanu is given a good performance in this, but there is a school of thought that he's a bit miscast in this, and I kind of agree with that, because given what they're doing with this character, you need to believe that he could be as awful a person as the film is making it out to be. And at no point in the film, with Keanu being his affable self, do you fully sort of buy into the fact that he could have been
there's a couple of moments where they try to make that clear.
They try, but it doesn't go far enough. And the fact that they are so unspecific about what the awful things he has done were works against the movie as well.
Well, because it turns out he doesn't know what the things are. So, you know. Anyway, we gave this 2 stars, so let's not dwell on it anymore. Let's talk instead about Glenn Rothen, which is, as we said, Brian Cox's directorial debut. He also plays one of the two main characters, who is Sandy, who's been running the family distillery since his brother Donal, who is the Alan Cumming character, went off to America years before following an unclear argument. And we gradually, during the course of the film, learn what drove them apart and see if there's any way for them to get back together. This is kind of an old-fashioned sort of a movie, isn't it?
Very much so. Very much so. I kind of dug it for the most part. I think Alan Cumming is at his best when he's on stage, much like his character in the film. Mm. When he's doing his singing, dancing act, he's actually really, really fun. And there's a few scenes of that. Brian Cox, he's not playing Logan Roy in this, although he does dip back into a succession bag of tricks, a couple of scenes, but for the most part, he's playing a character with a lot more warmth, and he's playing it very, very well. And, you know, he's an actor, he contains multitudes. I like that he's given himself this role.
Mm-hmm.
The theme of brotherly love eventually came through for me. That's kind of the spine of the film. Shirley Henderson might be the MVP of this entire thing for me. I thought she was great. She plays Jess, who had a relationship with Donal way back when, and she feels hurt by how Donal abandoned her.
Mm. And she's also Sandy's right-hand woman, so
yes,
it kind of works that well.
Yeah. And she is fantastic. So even though you see where it's going quite early on, the excavation of those wounds feels patient and at times is emotional. There are times when the script works against the actors, is quite cliched. The score is very cloying and treacly and just distracting at times. The direction, it's a directorial debut, it's fine, but it's unambitious. There's a lot of scenes which just feel quite static. I'm not sure if you felt the same way.
I didn't, to be honest, it didn't trip me, because I think it's quite it's quite a, you know, classic story. It's classically told. I didn't have an issue with that. I really enjoyed young Alexandra Wilkie as Sasha, who I thought was really good as the sort of Donald's granddaughter, and Alexandra Shipp as his daughter. They were nice. They didn't get enough to do, but they were nicely used.
That's what I was going to say.
But they did. And it's just quite a warm, nice film. I think it's a little bit Sunday night TV, but I don't mean that in a totally disparaging way. I also think, by the way, that Alan Cox gave a very good performance as his dad's dad. So he plays Sandy and Donald's father because he looks like a young Brian Cox, essentially. and I thought he was really good. He is also Watson in Young Sherlock Holmes.
Oh, is that good?
Fact fans. Have you never seen Young Sherlock Holmes?
Oh, I thought you meant that there is a new Young Sherlock as
No,
well.
No, it's the original Young Sherlock.
Oh, okay. Well, I haven't seen it either.
Oh, no, the new one is I've watched one episode, put it that way.
Okay.
Anyway, we haven't got an official Empire review. Would you say that's a three? I feel like it's a three.
It's a three.
I think it's a three. I want to very quickly talk about Thrash, which is a shark movie on Netflix. So basically, there's a big storm surge and also a tanker full of blood crashes in a small town. And wouldn't you know it, sharks invade the town. And a bunch of people have to try to survive the sharks. Fun?
Fun. Stupid. Rubbish.
Very stupid.
Very stupid, very rubbish. But I would be lying if I said I didn't have a fun time with this. It does some extremely stupid, over-the-top stuff in the last act, which made me clap on my sofa and the ridiculousness of it all. This is directed by Tommy Vercola, who made Dead Snow and Violent Night.
So he
knows like a pulpy premise and he leans into this. It's basically Crawl, but with sharks, but not as good as Crawl. Crawl is actually quite mean and very toothy. This is a bit toothless. But has some fun with it. Phoebe Dynevor from Bridgerton is in this. She is pregnant and she has a conversation with her mother at the start of the film where her mum is like, oh, before you exit the town that is about to flood, how are you feeling about having a water birth for your baby? And immediately you know where the third act of the film is going. There is an incredible deployment of millennial anthem, A Thousand Miles, Vanessa Carlton, that is just so stupid. And there's a great line involving Phoebe Dynevor in the final act, which deserves to go viral. I believe it already is. It's trashy. It's super trashy. It kind of knows it. You might watch it and be like, this is total trash. Why am I wasting my time?
Yep.
Or you might watch it and go, this is total trash.
I'm having a nice time.
Yeah, I'm having a nice time. Also, again, about like literally 75 minutes. We're not even talking like 90 minutes here. It's well sub 90.
It does lose some points for setting up its own sequel in the closing moments of the film.
Yes.
But, you know, I had a nice time. Nice to see Jaimin Hunsu playing essentially the shark expert who stands on the sidelines and goes, gosh, that would be awful.
I hope he makes it. But the Phoebe Dynevor has me automatically interested. I loved her in Fair Play, which is the ordinary.
But Amon, if you're thinking that's going to mean character development and depth of performance, you're not going to find it here.
Let us disabuse you of that notion immediately. Ben, you and I also wanted to pick up on something that came out a couple of weeks ago, I think now, which we missed at the time because Disney didn't tell us it was out. It's on Disney Plus, and that is Pizza Movie.
Pizza Movie!
Pizza Movie!
Pizza Movie is fun. This is a film by the duo known as Britannic. That's Brian McElhaney and Nick Kocher. Sorry if I've mangled names. I'm just going to call you Britannic. And you know in 21 Jump Street, the scene where they take the drug and they're tripping Major Ballsack.
Yep.
Pizza Movie is that as an entire movie. It's about two college friends who find some drugs that have fallen from the ceiling and they decide to take those drugs and quickly find out that they are in for a world of pain if they don't specifically eat pizza. So they order pizza and they have to go down two flights of stairs to get the pizza. And the entire film takes place within the span of them trying to get downstairs to eat this pizza. Meanwhile, all kinds of crazy time dilation stuff is happening because of the various stages of the drug trip that they're on. And it is just incredibly fun. It's full of inventive filmmaking and just packed with like little comedic details all in the exploit of making something completely stupid.
Yeah.
It's like very, very stupid and kind of smart at the same time. Gaten Matarazzo from Stranger Things, who to me was always one of the MVPs of that cast. He's incredibly good. Mm-hmm. He is one of the main guys along with Sean Jambroni, and they are both very funny together. They have a great dynamic. Lulu Wilson, who spent her entire childhood playing haunted little girls in things like Ouija, Origin of Evil, and Annabelle Creation, has grown up to be a slightly less haunted young woman, which is very nice to see. She gets to have fun and not be spooked by things for once. And they make a fun little trio as they kind of move through the stages of this drug trip together. And it's a really good time. I honestly did not expect much, but I saw the words pizza movie and I was like, I like both of those things. I like pizzas, I like movies, maybe I'll like a pizza movie. And I really did.
Did you eat pizza while watching the movie?
I didn't, and no, I really should have.
I'm planning a rewatch with my husband, and that's the plan for the rewatch. It is, this is really real stupid. I mean, it is really gonzo, bizarre craziness, but I had a great time with it. There's just some delightfully odd choices throughout the film, and some genre-bending, reality-bending stuff that really worked for me. It's kind of a throwback in a lot of ways to the kind of 80s, teen movie. It feels like a little bit Revenge of the Nerdsy. It feels like it's got a sort of... It just feels like it's harking back to something as well as being quite modern. So I just thought that was great.
It's also the stoner comedy thing of like Harold and Kumar and Jay and Silent Bob. And so the freewheeling silliness that you get from those films.
Yeah.
It gives them permission. The drug trip thing gives them permission to do some
to do
like
a lot
wacky
of that.
Shit.
Yeah. I can't believe it's on Disney. I genuinely can't. But we don't have an Empire review. Honestly, I'd be closer to a 4 on this one.
Yeah, I feel like this is something that I would give a 4, and then some people would yell at me and be like, why did you give Pizza Movie a 4? And I'll say, because it's a good pizza movie.
It's a fun time at the movies.
It is. In pizza terms, it is a Dr. Oetker, because it's cheap and it looks like it might be a bit rubbish, but actually it's delicious. I've said my piece. Wow. You've never had a Dr. Oetker?
No, I mean, I never would have particularly called it delicious, but like maybe that's just me.
Whoa. I wish you could see Ben's body language.
Sorry, I'm married to an Italian now. Like genuinely it would be cause for divorce if I were to say that I like a frozen pizza.
No, but that's the thing about the Dr. Oetker. It's not official Napoli pizza, because that is the Christopher Nolans and the Ryan Johnsons of this world. But this is Britannic, and this is Dr. Oetker, and they cooked, and it's delicious.
I will say that they cooked. I'm just not sure I can get on board with the full metaphor, genuinely. Grounds for divorce. Okay, I'm sorry, that was an epic review section, but we had to catch up on a couple of those from last week. But that is it now for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun, when we're going to be joined by the lovely David Lowery to talk about his new film, Mother Mary. From The Mummy to Mother Mary, you'd think that somebody had an Oedipus complex in the cinema these days, wouldn't you? My God, they're everywhere. But until then, until that auspicious occasion, until we meet again, it is goodbye from Amon Warman.
Peace.
It's goodbye from Ben Travis.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to sadly bin all of my Spaceballs, the Search for More Money merch that I'd had printed up in anticipation of this film's release. It's hard times at the movies. But in any case, we'll be back next week, and we look forward to seeing you then. Peace.
The weather in Central Ohio just got better, so why shouldn't your loan rate? CME Federal Credit Union wants to try to beat your current loan rate by 2% on autos and toys. Plus, enjoy no payments for 90 days on car loans and no payments for 60 days on motorcycles, boats, and more. With car rates as low as 4.99% APR and toy rates starting at 6.5% APR, it's the perfect time to save. Apply today at cmefcu.org.
Terms apply. Minimum floor rates, 4.99% APR cars, 6.50% APR, other vehicles, federally insured by NCUA.